And good evening. Welcome back. Wherever you are, it is the Christmas season. Hope all things are going well for you and you're out there smiling and bringing good Christmas cheer to all those around you. It's a very tense time of the year, but it's supposed to be fun, and I hope you are having that and then some. We have a knockout program for you tonight. This is a very important program. It's one man's story of bringing the truth as he came to recognize and be introduced to it to all of us. It's a legacy we deserve to have. He's very courageous. He is a remarkable man. And what you're about to hear is still classified, I am told, top secret by the United States Air Force. Now, I'm not violating any national security issues here as far as I'm concerned. After 60 years, it can finally be looked at in the light of day, the true story of the U.S. involvement in the design and the construction of what are commonly called flying saucers. This is not your run-of-the-mill, lights-in-the-sky saucer story. In this case, the dates, names, and locations of very specific personnel and hardware can now be identified, which point to a very terrestrial explanation for many of the UFO sightings beginning back in 1947. The case for all this, that there are U.S.-built flying wing disc aircraft, also called flying saucers, begins with the unprecedented true account of my guest tonight, and we're going to call him just Jack. He is a retired World War II combat veteran. He is a patriot, a publisher, and a remarkable man, and I'm very honored to have him on the program tonight. Jack, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Glad you're here.
Okay.
Believe me, I'm glad you're here. Now, this story is a big one. It is much to your credit that you've come forward with it. And before I get into the story, I'd just like to ask you, I always like to pay tribute to our World War II, Korean War, Vietnam vets when they're on the program. Tell me a little bit about what your service in World War II was like, would you please, Jack?
Well, I was a gunner's mate on a destroyer out in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
I was in about five major battles out there. That's all history now, too.
It is indeed. It is indeed. I still have visual images in my mind of watching the old Victory at Sea series of some
I
of the battles.
That too.
Yeah, I'll bet you did. You might even have seen yourself in it.
I saw my ship on there.
Did you really? That's fascinating. Okay, tell us how this whole flying saucer thing bumped into your life.
Well, it was one of those things you're really not even contemplating. It all started actually because of going fishing. And my partner Harold and I were doing a publication for the MacDill Air Force Base down in Florida.
Right.
And we had a habit of eating lunch there, and they had a sea trout fish fry.
Uh-huh.
And boy, was it ever good. So he was talking to the cook of where could we, because they said they caught them right there near the bay.
Uh-huh.
So they told us how to get down to that fishing area. And in a day or two, we started down there to go fishing. And there had been a rather cold season in Florida some months previous to that. And
right.
All the foliage wasn't on the trees as it usually is.
Mm-hmm.
You could kind of see through it. So we were on a street looking to get down on the south end of the base. And I saw four aircraft sitting over there behind the fence of the base just briefly. And Harold saw them too, and our comment was, my gosh, those look like flying saucers. Let's go see if we can get a closer look at them. So
this is a chain-link security fence around the base that you're looking through. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And we were a block away from it. But there wasn't any houses or anything in there. It was just
right
there. And you could see because the leaves and stuff, the foliage wasn't on the trees.
Mm-hmm.
So we drove over there, and it was a perimeter road, and we drove up close to it. And sure enough, there was no mistaking that they were flying saucers.
How many of these were there? Four?
Four, yes. They
all
were sized from 20 feet, approximately 40 feet, 70 feet, and 116 feet.
Four different sizes.
Yes. And then they had some 10-foot drones that were being scrapped. They didn't have any complete ones of those there.
This was a scrap yard, so these items were about to be chopped up, I guess.
A bunch of them had been. from what I was told later.
Uh-huh.
In fact, those four, the officer in charge who was briefing about the story later, or briefing me, told me that they were still in determination whether to scrap them or keep them for the new Air Force Museum hadn't been built yet.
Right.
And they had a bunch of film and movies and everything else on them that they had planned on sending with the aircraft and opening it up to the general public at the time.
Wow. All right. So what happened? Did you go fishing or did you turn around just scratching your heads and go home?
Well, oddly enough, you couldn't get through that fence or anything.
Right.
And we were so close to where it was fishing, and it had been kind of bad weather. We tried driving on down there, but the road was waterlogged, and we turned around and went back.
So you did.
And we discussed, those are real flying saucers. And they were the most beautiful aircraft I had ever seen. And we were doing the base publication for the NCO club there. And the sergeant who did a lot of the articles and did the calendar work for us had gone on furlough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out to the base to get the filler for the base part of the magazine.
Sure.
And they didn't have it because he'd been on furlough.
Oh.
So I told the master sergeant in charge of the club that I had to have something for filler. If nothing else, get his Polaroid camera out and take pictures of events and stuff going on there. And I asked him, what about those aircraft down there at the end of the field that looked like flying saucers? And he says, yeah, he knew they were there. He says he didn't know anything about them. They'd been there quite some length of time, but no one on base really seemed to know much about them. And he says, I don't know whether they're still secret or not. So he said, I'll call and find out.
Now, who is this person you're talking to?
He was the man who had charge of running the NCO club.
Okay. And this is a small publication. How many copies would you produce?
About 2,500.
Okay.
It was just for the members of the NCO club and their families.
I understand.
And it was an advertising media for the club itself to get their people in there to participate in what they were doing. And to pay for it, we sold advertising.
Mm-hmm.
The local businesses, and
mm-hmm.
It was really, on an average, about 24 pages.
How long had these items been parked there at that point in time? Did you ever come up with any idea? Months? Or?
Well, the closest that I could ever come up with, I asked that sergeant whether or not we could use them in that magazine.
Yes.
And he said, well, he didn't know anything about them. He says, they've been there several years. And as near as I could find out, it was just an estimate, because he never did just specifically say they were there on such and such a date, but I would say somewhere between 3 and 5 years.
Had he ever gone over there himself and taken
No.
a close-up look?
No, he said nobody on base ever went over there. And I found out later from the officers in charge of that they had never let anyone set foot on those aircraft since the day they had landed and been parked there.
Wow.
They did scrap a whole bunch of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know for sure how many.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite an aircraft. That big one carried evidently drone radio-controlled flying bombs. They were discs. And they flew so fast and so high that they could hit with pinpoint accuracy and launch those things from thousands of feet up in the air, going thousands of miles an hour, and the enemy never knew what hit them. We never used them as such, but that's what they were designed for.
So, all right, now the four craft, and what we're going to do in a few minutes, we're going to be putting up a link to some illustrations. They're computer-generated graphics of these craft, not the four we're talking about, but of these type of craft that the Air Force had built and was flying for who knows how long, at least, what, 15 or 20 years, we think, Jack?
Oh, yeah, well, one of the planes that I saw had been in the formation flight that was spotted and reported by the media that coined the term flying saucers.
Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947. How do we know that?
Well, the officer in charge told me that. I asked him, were these the aircraft that everybody was calling flying saucers, and
mm-hmm.
he gave me an affirmative reply, and he said, in fact, that second one down there was in that flight. And the, amazing the way certain things come about. It's hilarious, but I haven't really seen a lot of the stuff yet or heard a lot of the stuff yet that I later did.
Yes.
When they took me into that library.
Okay.
And he told me that I could go down there, and I says, well, I've got a small son and daughter. I'd like to kick the tires of that one so I could tell them that their dad had kicked those tires for real flying saucer.
You bet. I'd like to, too.
And they did, and they took a picture of it.
Wow. Stand by, Jack, if you would. We'll pause. Come right back, and we'll get ready in just a few minutes. I'm going to put that link up, make it active. You'll see it right in the guest section, U.S. Air Force UFOs. Done by Michael Schratt, and he is a gifted artist. These are some stunning computer images that you're going to be seeing in just a few minutes. And we'll continue with our world exclusive with Jack in just a couple minutes. Glad you're along. I'll be right back. Back about the U.S. Air Force top secret flying saucer program. Now, Jack, what year was this that you came across, you and your friend, these four craft of varying sizes, perfect discs, and we'll all show you pictures in just a couple minutes, so stay tuned.
In 1967, as I mentioned, I asked that club manager if we could maybe use an article or something, pictures on those aircraft for
sure. Sure.
And because he had Polaroid cameras, we weren't allowed to take cameras on base. So he didn't know. He called the base administration somewhere and coincidentally found out that the Air Force had been considering releasing a story on those remaining aircraft, and they decided that his NCO Club calendar magazine would be ideal to do it. So that's how we got into it.
Wow. All right. So this fellow you talked to at the base,
yes,
was what, the officer in charge or one of the ranking officers there?
Oh, yes. He seemed to be in charge of the entire library, and it wasn't long ago I made up my own mind that those things were still top secret. It turned out that they were declassifying them for that article. But when the sergeant got permission from me to, rather than use a Polaroid camera, they said that they had photographs that they would rather we used in his magazine. And they asked my all kinds of information, what kind of car, and gave me directions how to get to the facility where they met me, and I was met by armed military guard, and they told me exactly what to expect. Sure enough, I was escorted inside that building and under armed military guard, finally taken up to what turned out to be one of their top secret libraries on flying discs.
This is on the base?
On the base itself, yes.
Okay, so, well, tell us a little bit. I'm going to hear about this library, about flying discs. What was it like in there? File cabinets, books on shelves?
File cabinets, big long tables, desks, that type of thing. And the colonel, lieutenant colonel that took me in there, there was an armed guard inside there.
Inside, armed guard. What, was he carrying a sidearm or a rifle?
Some of them had weapons they were carrying, like automatic rifles, and some of them were pistols.
All right. So this is
quite a few. In other words, it was an armed guard. It was under guard.
High security. Okay.
Yes.
Now this is again top secret. What amazes me is that they'd park these things out there where people could actually drive by and you could have taken a picture of them through the fence.
Yep.
And no one did.
But what they had been scrapping those, and they had those four left. The story that officer told me was that they decided to declassify them, and they were no longer considered top secret. But the facility I was in was sure top secret, which was a reason for military guard.
Did you see, what, film projectors in there or anything like that, like a screen? Or
yes, there was a screen in there. In fact, they had a row of film, like the old movie newsreel film.
Right.
Clear across one wall, and it was all film the Air Force had made about these aircraft. And the officer told me that the same as when they come out with B-17s and everything else, they made brief film things and sent them to the news media throughout the country and the theaters and showed the people in that way. Well, that's what they had planned to do with these, but they had never done it up to that point yet.
And the idea that they were going to declassify these for your magazine must have made you feel kind of privileged, didn't it? That's pretty big stuff.
Well, not only that, I mean, my interest really went into high gear when I saw that they were what looked to me like flying saucers. And then when they were confirmed, he told me, he says, you just ask any question you want. This was for the proposed article. And he said, I'll either answer you or I won't. But let's try to get questions that would be of general interest to anyone. So my first one was, are these the aircraft that's been being called flying saucers? And he says, yes, they are. I says, are they responsible for all that stuff of aliens and alien spaceships at Roswell? And he says, yes, we had accidents. And then he reached into one of the files and he pulled out photographs of the type aircraft that had been involved in those crashes. But he says, we're not going to run anything on that now.
Did he show you the pictures?
Yes.
What did they look like? The round discs?
Well, one of them was a round disc, one was almost triangle, and one of them was kind of a three-quarter moon shape. But I didn't get to... He didn't even let me hold those.
He did show you, though.
But he did show them to me, and I asked him, well, what about this small alien? And during World War II, when we needed increased aircraft production to get inside the wings and riveting, they hired a whole bunch of small stature human being, midgets, that type of people, so they could get up in there and get the things riveted. When they got into the development of these, what originally started out, I guess, as German flying bombs, they were so small that they made the cockpit where the bomb was going to go, and the engines and stuff were so hot that we didn't have such things as flight suits and helmets and that type of thing. Then they had to develop all of that so that the pilot could survive.
Okay, all right, let me ask you to pause right there. Now, the Air Force, as you can follow along, is you're telling Jack at this point in time that, yes, their hardware accounted for all the UFO activity and all the reports. So this is the first planned Air Force announcement about this thing, and you can rest assured that a great deal of thought was given to the information that was planned to be released through Jack and his publication. Okay, we're going to pause. I'm putting the link up right now. Go to guests, look for UFO right under the name of our program tonight. It'll be a hot link. Okay, for all of you online, the link is hot, and you can click on it. Says USAF UFOs. These are all done by Michael Schratt, who is gifted, as you can tell when you look at these images. There are a couple of photographs. They are composites. These are basically crafts that have been inserted into photographs. Other than they are, otherwise you can tell by looking at them that they are complete constructions by a computer. But they're just amazing. Jack, this is your story. It's fascinating. You've looked at these pictures. Are you able to see them now?
Yes, I am.
Okay. This craft meets your specifications how closely to what you saw? You saw these up close, too. And all the pictures you were shown, the movie footage you were shown, is this exactly what they look like?
Well, in particular, the one where that guy has got a forum of people there, that looks almost identical. And then the one that has the two on there and the accompanying fighter planes by it, those two look exactly alike.
So at the very last picture on the bottom where there's the big craft and then the smaller craft and then two fighter aircraft parked?
Yes.
That's what you saw?
Yes, sir.
Now, the bigger of, again, you mentioned four sizes. The largest one, and we can see that in the very last picture on that string, is approximately, what did they tell you the diameter of it was? Did they give you the exact diameters?
Yeah, he told me to ask whatever I wanted, and I said, well, how big is that big one?
Yeah.
He says, I asked me if I'd ever seen a B-47. I says, yeah. He says, well, it was just about the wingspan of a B-47. And he was using the film that they had taken the B-47s to show the general public to talk about the film that they were making of these discs.
Uh-huh.
Before I forget, those little ones were like the drones. They were radio controlled, and some of the larger ones were too, and especially that 40-foot and the 20-foot. And when they didn't have a human pilot in them, they had such intense speed that they could make maneuvers that no human being could survive at all. And that's where a lot of that story of the alien myth came in,
mm-hmm.
because these aircraft outflew anything in the world for a while.
So this was
Russia,
the...
Russia had them too, you want to know.
Okay. This was the plan of the Air Force to go public at this time in 1967,
yes.
and to just basically say, here are the UFOs, this is what people have been seeing, there is nothing from off-planet, it's been us all along. They were willing to go that far?
Yes, they were writing a full center page, that's the full inside pages of the magazine.
Uh-huh.
And the I asked him, what are you going to call us? And he says, well, what do you think? I says, well, why not put a big headline on there, Flying Saucers for Real, exclamation point. He says, that's it. And that was going to be on the front cover. Then a full description and a full, as much as whatever they were going. I never did see their complete release because they decided against it before I went to press with it.
But you had it all mocked up and...
I had 16 photographs all chosen, everything. Plus, I had interviewed him and gotten all kinds of information that I couldn't take any of that information out of that room with me. I was there 3 days, during 3 days, and I had to leave it when I left. And he said I'd get it all back when they got ready to go to press with it.
I see. But clearly you were aware that this was a major deal coming down from the Pentagon. This is a big release of information.
Yeah, they told me so. They told me that in questioning and talking to that officer, I mentioned the secrecy, and he says, well, this was really as secret as the Manhattan Project. And there has never been any aircraft that we had come close to them,
mm-hmm.
at that point anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did they ever tell you, and as you folks are looking at the images, the larger craft, 130-some feet in diameter. 116. Crew of 5 to 6, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
I walked underneath that aircraft.
How did the skin of it look to you?
Well, to me, it looked like an aluminum airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not interested in technicalities. I mean, I was darn sure interested in looking at what they were showing me and hearing what they were.
Mm-hmm.
But they had control of everything that was going to go in there, so
yeah.
I was just playing it by ear. Whatever come up, why, great.
Did you see rivets?
Well, I don't know that they were rivets, but there you could see that something was holding it together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You could see seams, in other words.
It was the most beautiful aircraft I've ever seen, before or since.
Was it all of them. Was it polished, brushed aluminum?
Yeah, it had a shiny surface to it.
Uh-huh.
It didn't look weathered at all. The tires on all of them were flat. It did park there that long, and the main landing gear, the big one, had started collapse on the port side.
No kidding.
Yeah. But I asked him about... why they decided to give me pictures rather than take pictures of those aircraft in that condition.
So they were just literally starting to, well, not fall apart, but they were clearly just abandoned. I mean,
well, I asked him about that, and he said, no, he says, the decision hasn't been made yet whether to go ahead and scrap them or to transfer them for use in the new Air Force Museum. I says, well, I asked a real foolish question. They laughed immediately. I said, well, how'd they get them in here? He says, well, we flew them in here. And, of course, obviously, I'm on an Air Force business as
sure.
well. And he says, we can make them flyable rather rapidly and get them out of here or transport them. And, but you want to remember, we're talking about aircraft. When I asked him about, he let me ask any question I wanted. And when I asked him about how many and how high and how fast,
mm-hmm.
and he got up into thousands of miles an hour airspeed and umpteen thousand feet up in the air, he says, we went fast enough, we actually achieved space flight in them. Well, I said, you've got to be going 15,000 miles an hour or more to get into space. He says, that's right. I says, you mean you're going that fast? He says, yeah. He says, in fact, if we'd have had different power surface engines, we could have gone into orbit. Well, I knew that was 17.5. And he says, but we never did get that fast. And of course, I asked him how in the world they got something that fast back into down into the air. And
in the lower altitudes, yeah. What did he have to say about the propulsion of these craft? Did he explain any of that to you?
No, he said all that would be, I asked him, he says, that'll all be in the release. And he had showed me, I had to lay out enough space for him to have a full inside spread
right.
for that.
Right.
Plus, they were going to have captions under all 18 of the photographs.
Right. Did he show?
No, a lot of that stuff I never got to see.
Mm. Did they show you any film footage at all?
They showed me the film. They unreeled it out there and put it up so I could see what it was.
Ah, but they didn't run it through a projector.
They didn't run it through a projector, no.
Okay. All right. Hold on again, Jack, if you would. We'll pause as we look at these photographs and consider what may be going on here with the release of information like that, at least the plan at the time to release information, the ramifications of such, how it would impact people who had, by the mid-60s, been seeing UFO discs for about 20 years or more. We all remember the big flaps of the 1950s, at least those of us who study the issue of UFO history. These are remarkable craft. Take a look at the pictures. We'll be right back. Jack, just a minute. Let me remind you that these illustrations are, there are a couple of photographs in there quite clearly, and they're composites of photographs and computer-generated art. They are all copyrighted by Michael Schratt, and you'll have to talk to him about any reproduction rights. So keep that in mind. We're talking with Jack. Let me take you back when you walked under the large craft.
Okay.
That was outside, and it had been abandoned to the extent that the tires had gone flat, had been sitting there for a year or two or more. You walked under this thing. Did you see anything on the bottom that looked like propulsion vents or jet ducts?
The four exhausts, that big one had four air intakes, great big ones, along two on each side of the fuselage.
Okay.
And it had two exhausts. Good-sized ones on the bottom of each side of the fuselage.
So there were four exhausts underneath, four intakes underneath. On the top, suggestive of four turbojet engines.
Some kind of jet, for sure.
Yeah.
And it looked like what could have been a bomb bay, but it wasn't open. I think that's where they carried those 20-foot flying bombs.
So the smaller discs would have fit within the larger disc.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
In fact, that officer said that big one had carried those air radio control drones.
Inside it, not attached underneath it.
He didn't specify.
Okay, all right. The four ports would be to the rear as we look at the craft. Did it have any kind of vectoring flaps, or were they just holes?
To me, they were just holes. I didn't even know what a vectoring flap was.
Okay.
I was publishing a magazine.
I understand, but your eyeballs must have been doing pinwheels.
It was. I was amazed. Believe me, I was full of interest, and I asked a ton of questions, and I got answers that were fantastic.
Do you think that some of the answers, now realizing this is a huge declassification of a project that had been going on since World War II, do you think some of the information you were being given might have been spun to create a certain expected reaction in the public?
I have no way of knowing. I would be surmising just like you.
Mm-hmm.
All I can go by is what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind being specific about that, but
sure.
Anything of my own imagination is no better than yours.
Right. Right. Okay. Now, the obvious question comes up. If we had these craft, why continue to build traditional aircraft when we had such mastery of the air, if in fact these were that kind of achievement?
I asked them why they had discontinued that particular one. Remember, this was a horizontal takeoff aircraft.
Right. It would roll down the runway.
Yes.
And lift into the air. Right, okay, traditional.
And he said, well, he said, we have better ones, and we corrected some of the maneuverability problems. And I know as fact because I got the declassification on Silverbug myself from the Air Force, and that was a VTOL, straight up and down.
You did?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the public domain now because I released it in there. But the gist of the thing was, I have no idea exactly why, except they just decided they were going to release the story about
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, how come not before? And he says, well, he says, we've started to do this several times. And he says, the general public, we have such a flap. Anytime there's anything to do with a flying saucer that we just don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, the general public seem to be more interested in flying aliens and flying saucers than they are for real aircraft. And that was his total explanation of that.
Hmm. Were these discs nuclear capable? Could they have delivered nuclear weapons? Obviously they could.
They did have nuclear capability. And I know as fact they were testing some of them, of the flying bombs down at Eglin in Florida when the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
They were scheduled to be carrying nuclear bombs for our war in Europe. But the war ended before they ever used them.
Did the officer in command that was giving you this briefing talk to you about overflights over the Soviet Union? This is the height of the Cold War.
I asked him about it specifically. He says, yes, we overflew Russia, but you can't print that. And that was his whole... He didn't give me any information other than, yes, they had been. But he also told me that they had been overflying us. You know, Russia captured most of those factories right at the end of the war.
The German.
They took the whole works of them into Russia, and they built these aircraft with those engineers, and they began overflying the United States right after the end of World War II.
Francis Gary Powers overflew the Soviet Union and got shot down. These discs could clearly outperform the U-2.
Sure.
So apparently no problem.
But as I say, I didn't get other than I got the tremendous speed that they had,
mm-hmm.
the altitude capabilities that they had, and that they were building them for every use the Air Force had. Then they decided to come out with a better one. And, in fact, one of the better ones is one of the reasons this story was canceled.
Because they decided to keep a lid on the whole concept that the Air Force had flying discs.
Yeah, they had a overflight over Miami. In fact, I was going to press with, going out to pick everything up and go down to printer.
Mm-hmm.
And the night before, they had this overflight over Miami. It hit headlines everywhere. So I bought a copy of the Tampa Tribune and took it out there with me.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, of course, it said the Air Force is dying everything. And I mentioned to that colonel, I said, here, you've got a problem, I think, because you're getting ready within a week. I'm going to have a magazine in your club.
Mm-hmm.
Flying saucers for real, and 18 pictures of flying saucers in it, and here these newspapers are saying that the Air Force is denying they have any knowledge of it. And he told me that he knew what the aircraft was that had caused that. It had taken off from Avon Park, and Avon Park doesn't have long runways, so it had to be a vertical takeoff, VTOL-type aircraft.
Avon Park is what, a smaller Air Force base?
Yeah, it's over near the coast, southeast of Tampa.
So your guess is by the late 1960s, the Air Force had VTOL discs.
Oh, yes. In fact, Project Silverbug was flying before that, and the offshoot of them, the Harrier, is the result of those aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I didn't see the written article by the Air Force that they were going to what they were going to say. But I do know that when I took that paper and talked to him about it, he said, well, he had to check with higher authority, and he'd come back in maybe 15 minutes, and they had called every division of the Department of Defense. And he told me, he says, we've decided it's in the better interest of the Air Force not to release this right now. And he began picking up the pictures and everything else.
And what did he tell you about keeping your mouth closed?
Nothing. He says, maybe in 30, 60 days we'll go with it. And I flat told him, I says, we are here to publish magazines for your NCO clubs and
yeah.
not to cause any flap to the Air Force at all. We depend on it for our livelihood. If it's going to cause you any problem, we'd rather not. But if you want us to publish it, just let me know, and I'll publish as many copies as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And left it open that if he decided to do that, to give us a call. I never heard from him again.
Nice fella?
Oh, yeah, principal guy. And very informative. In fact, he mentioned to me when they were going to pull the article, they weren't going to release it. He says the next time, he says no one will ever see this type of aircraft again until they come up as our spaceships. You know, amazingly, in 72, we built the runway for our supposedly new spaceships at Hunter Airfield in Savannah, Georgia.
Right.
So we've never got the aircraft there yet.
Right. Now, that's a whole other story, and I want to keep you over for maybe 20 minutes, another 30 minutes, to talk about World War II, about that extraordinary runway that the Germans have built, and the fact that we built one here as well. I mean, we're talking a runway with a length of how many miles, Jack?
5 miles.
A 5-mile-long runway, which we're going to hear about. We'll talk more about the German program in World War II as well. Of course, they had the advanced technology with the Messerschmitt 262, those amazing Horton Brothers flying wing designs. Just some incredible technology, which were, in fact, the greatest spoils of war. And as you heard Jack say, the Russians disassembled entire factories in the eastern part of Germany, took them back to the Soviet Union, and reconstructed them with all the captured scientists as well. So this links directly into the German World War II flying disc program that we have done so many programs on over the years. This is a very key component of all that. So take a look at the pictures, all done by Michael Schratt. We're very much indebted to Michael for sharing those and for allowing me to release them on my website. And even more indebted to Jack for sharing his story. We'll hear more from Jack in just a few minutes. And we'll talk also about another World War II American hero, a Flying Tigers pilot, who also saw one of these discs, but about 15 years after 1967. That's an extraordinary story in and of itself, and I spoke to that man for over an hour on the phone today. We'll talk about that as we continue our discussion on U.S. Air Force flying disc technology in just a few minutes. Hack Hour number 2. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along. Thanks for choosing to spend your time here tonight. We're learning some amazing things. This is Jack's story. It's his story, his interaction with the officer in charge at MacDill, and what he learned, all the photographs he saw, the film he was shown, at least stretched out, the magazine article he was given permission and had all blocked out, ready to go to press, but which was withdrawn at the last minute. Air Force apparently, in this period of time, struggling with the idea of going public with its disc technology, decided not to because they had a bigger and better model or models. And they didn't want to, I guess, own up to any of it. If you're going to keep the lid on something, I guess you keep it on permanently. You don't just leave it half on. That seems to be the thinking, at least. Jack, did this man, when he was talking to you at any time, exhibit hesitation, nervousness, or did he, you said he was a prince of a guy. Did he act as if he was on strings from above? How did he act?
He acted like he knew exactly what he was doing. Very knowledgeable.
Did he act as if he knew exactly how to handle you and shepherd this whole disclosure to the degree that it might have been not that you were misused, but that you were being used to put a multi-pronged agenda forward into the public's mind with this, if this had gone ahead and been released?
I didn't see any indication of that at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the reason, the reason they withdrew the article right then was the evening before they had that major sighting over Miami.
And that was one of their newer models, you said?
Yes. This officer told me he knew about that aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
It had malfunctioned and very nearly crashed into Miami itself. They were trying to get it crash land in the ocean. When they got it working, it went right straight up and out of sight. And it had so much headline that they decided to not publish that story right then.
So that stopped it?
That stopped it. Dead in its tracks.
Okay, now give me a little bit more on this issue of the craft in trouble, almost crashing. How did you come up with that? Did he tell you that?
He told me that. When I told him about the, I had the Tampa Tribune Herald there with the headlines on it.
Do you remember the date?
It was sometime in October, November of 67.
Okay.
And that's all it was on there. And in there, the Air Force denied any knowledge of that aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And this officer told me, yes, he knew about that aircraft. It had taken off from Avon Park. Well, the only way it could have taken off from Avon Park, it had to be VTOL.
Okay.
Because it didn't have any lengthy runways.
All right.
And he said it had a malfunction, and they got it fixed, and it went right straight up out of sight, and that was the end of that. And he said, but, he says, we're going to have to do a little, he says, I'm going to have to double check before we go ahead with this. And he excused himself, and he come back, and he says, well, we contacted the Department of Defense, we contacted OFAC, we contacted the Pentagon, and the Department of the Air Force, and we decided at this time it's not, it would be the better interest of the Air Force to not release it right now. And he began gathering up photographs.
Right in front of you, just picking them up.
Yep. I knew when he reached for the first one that it was over.
What did you say? Anything? Can I have one?
There wasn't much I could say except about the other stuff. He wasn't going to give me any of it. He says, well, I will give you your notes back. And he gave me the notes back that I had.
What about the picture of you kicking the tire of the...
He wouldn't let me have that either. Frankly, I never saw that one because it was taken by an Air Force photographer. But I do know they were down there and took a picture of it.
Fascinating. All right, let me rewind now and go back to World War II. All the talk and the mystery, the intrigue about the German flying disc program. You heard about it probably in the 50s or 60s. It was talked about back then. There were actually books out on the subject.
Even before that.
So this wasn't a real big surprise to you in the sense that you had heard about discs being engineered by the Germans before.
Well, I heard about flying saucers, et cetera. They didn't call them flying discs. They were all called flying saucers.
Right.
Remember, that aircraft was the fastest, most maneuverable airplane that had ever been flying. It outflew everything.
All right. The runway in Europe that was overrun by, I guess, Patton.
Yeah.
And the Americans. Tell me more about that.
Okay. I went to do the publications at Savannah. And they were just completing a massive runway, and they didn't have very many personnel or aircraft in there. And so I, of course, was wondering about the personnel to support a publication like mine so I could sell advertising to the local advertisers. He says, no, they're coming in.
Right.
I says, what is this runway? He says, well, come, let me show you.
When you say Savannah, are you talking about an Air Force facility?
Savannah, Georgia.
It's an Air Force facility outside Savannah?
Savannah, Georgia is Savannah, Georgia.
Okay.
And there was Savannah Army Airfield at Savannah, Georgia.
Got it. All right.
It's now Air Force, but then it was the only last remaining Army airfield.
Okay.
And he showed me, he says, let me show you something. And he got out Patton's biography on him and the memos of Patton.
Who is this person doing you the favor of showing you this?
The officer in charge.
At Savannah?
At Savannah, yeah, at the Officers Club, the club I was going to do.
Okay.
And
these are Patton's
actual...
Excuse me, are these Patton's actual records or just transcriptions of them?
They were transcriptions of his records.
Okay.
And in them he said that he had... that they had come across this long, long runway and that it had... the far end of the thing tilted upwards, kind of like a ski jump. And he had no idea what in the world. field it was for, only he estimated that it had taken years and that they had used up tens of thousands of lives to make it.
5 miles long.
5 miles long, 200 feet wide and 14 foot thick.
14 feet thick?
Yeah.
Concrete.
Concrete. And it's still setting down there at Savannah, Georgia.
Right now?
Yep. In fact, I called not long back to see if it's for our horizontal takeoff space shuttles to replace the ones we have now, but we've never got them successfully going yet.
Mm-hmm.
But they planned on using that field for them. And I called to see whether we had any of our test aircraft down there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just put asphalt over the top of it, but nobody knew anything other than that I got to talk to.
Okay, this is for horizontal, traditional takeoff space planes.
Yeah, well, our space shuttle is supposed to do that. It's supposed to take off, go up there, switch into a different power source engine for space.
Well, this goes back to the days when they were trying to decide which shuttle proposal to construct, and they went with the one that was vertical takeoff, the one we know now. They could have built one that would have used that runway, apparently.
Well, in 72, they finished the runway.
It's just sitting there waiting now. Yeah. Okay, now, there was another man who saw one of these enormous craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to just find this particular little vignette on him and read it to you. Okay, this is called Encounter at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This is written by Michael Schratt. Fortunately, the story doesn't end in 1967. Jack was informed that the four disks parked at the scrap area were the very last of their kind and were awaiting orders to either be scrapped or flown and transported to Offutt Air Force Base for storage or the yet-to-be-completed Air Force Museum. You've heard all this earlier. I'm just reading what's in the little synopsis here. This brings us to Mr. Warren G. Botz, B-O-T-Z. Warren is a retired World War II P-40 Warhawk Flying Tigers pilot with over 30,000 hours of flight time in 119 different types of aircraft. In September of 1978, Warren was attending a reunion with his fellow pilots and their wives at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. A medium-sized group of about 62 people, including Warren, were transported by bus across the base to where the restoration hangar is located. It's here the various older aircraft are processed and made ready for the Air Force Museum. Arriving at Hangar 4, the group departed the bus and began walking through each of the hangars by way of a connecting doorway. Now, you can see a photograph in our group of pictures, by the way, of these hangars. Warren momentarily departed from his group and managed to walk through the door of Hangar 4, Bay E. Taking up the entire hangar was the identical craft that Jack saw at MacDill Air Force Base in 1967, the big one. Through telephone conversations with Mr. Botz, it became apparent that what he saw was the large 116-foot diameter craft. Warren was only in this hangar for about 2 minutes, but was able to confirm many of the details mentioned by my guest Jack that he saw 12 years earlier. And I'll be back with the rest of Mr. Botz's story in just a couple minutes. Okay, right back with you. Let me finish this little vignette of what Warren G. Botz saw at Wright-Patterson, 1978, September. As you look at those pictures, look for the photographs of the five hangars. You'll see them. Scroll on down. The hangar on the far right is the one in which Warren Botz saw the big disc, the 116-foot in diameter craft. Warren was only in the hangar for about 2 minutes, but was able to confirm many of the details mentioned by Jack and his encounter with these four discs 12 years earlier. Mr. Botz clearly remembers seeing the tricycle landing gear along with a very high vertical tail. Warren also recalled that the main landing gear strut looked as thick as a telephone pole. The nose gear strut was very similar in appearance to that of a French supersonic Concorde. Warren recalls seeing what looked like Venetian blinds or thrust vectoring vanes inside the exhaust ports. He also recalled seeing landing gear strut scissors. These devices are used to prevent the gear strut shafts from popping out of their cylinders. Warren was in a hangar for about 2 minutes, as I said, when a security guard who was stationed near the corner of the hangar intercepted him as he was walking toward one of the main landing gear struts. At that point, Warren was politely escorted out of the hangar. As he was leaving, Warren was able to look back and get one final look at this monster, his exact word, of an aircraft. In fact, after seeing the illustrations used for tonight's program and in Michael Schratt's article, extended article on this, Warren declared, "That's the exact aircraft I saw at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base." He also described that when he entered the hangar where the large disc was being kept, it was parked nose first into the hangar. He went on to describe how the aircraft was towed into the hangar. At first glance, it would appear that the tail was too tall to fit in through the hangar door. There's a slat up there, you can see it. But through the use of a special wheeled ramp, the aircraft is rolled up onto the ramp, nose first, dipping the back tail down so it can be pulled right on in to the hangar. And during a special conversation with Warren Botts, Michael Schratt described the long cabin section on top as looking like one half of a fuselage. Okay. Jack, it's not a surprise to you, but it's got to be a great source of confirmation that Warren Botts walked into this hangar by himself and saw the same type, maybe even the same craft that you saw 12 years earlier.
Yes, I heard about it with great interest. There's been any number of reports, his being the only one that I believe actually happened.
I talked to Mr. Botts today on the phone for over an hour, just so you all know, and just an extraordinary man. Told me about the World War II flying tigers in China and all the things he did there. As Jack's integrity is extraordinary, so is Warren's. This is real. Where the program is today, God only knows. Jack, where do you think we are today with it?
Well, I think we're on the verge of developing a space shuttle that takes off like an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And not long after that, we'll be using different power source engines and go into full-fledged space flight.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get different systems in order to do it.
Right. Anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to touch on right now?
No, other than I would like to emphasize that the officer who briefed me convinced me without question that there was never any such thing as aliens or alien spacecraft, that every one of the accidents was one of our own test aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to really follow the flying saucer stories, but once I found out what they were, why, I lost interest.
Okay,
like
so
I kicked the tires for a real one.
Yeah, he made a special effort then to make that clear to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, right. I asked him specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And he answered me, and that's when he showed me the pictures of the type aircraft that had crashed. But he said, we're not going to say anything about those in this article.
Mm-hmm. Did he show you the Roswell crash site picture?
No,
did he identify it?
I have no idea. He just showed me, picked out four photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of them was a different shaped aircraft. And he held them up for me to see. He says, this is the type aircraft that was involved in accidents. He said, yes, we had accidents, and when we did, we had all kinds of rumors going on.
I'll bet. Okay, let's do this. I want to thank you right now. I'm going to wrap this up for this visit. You've done a wonderful job explaining this, your story, Jack. You made a major contribution to fill in a lot of blanks. We'll talk again, and we'll follow this very closely. Thank you very much for being here on behalf of a lot of people. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Jack. Okay, we'll pause. Lots to think about here. Think about what the Air Force might have wanted to accomplish, multiple things, by releasing that story in 1967, which they did not do. Interesting piece of the puzzle. Technology that clearly exists, and where it is now, who knows? But take a look at those pictures, all by Michael Schratt, and we'll be back. All right, we're back. Pretty fascinating material. A lot of that ought to give people food for thought for months to come. There are obviously many, many types of craft in the skies above us. I don't think anyone seriously researching ufology would think that the dozens of types of objects seen up there would be explained away with terrestrial technology. However, there is clearly some extraordinary hardware that has been created by us folks that's flying around. This early evidence of it should, I think, keep people looking on both sides of the fence, perhaps a little more than some do. But it's a remarkable thing to finally have out on the table. And I'm very glad that Jack agreed to come on the program tonight and talk about it. And Michael Schratt, we salute you for your marvelous artwork and putting together a report, which we will make available to all of you out there through the Rents.com website, which encapsulates tonight's discussion and adds to it. We'll do that very soon. Okay.